This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran offers its assessment of the European Union's draft proposal to revive the 2015 nuclear agreement, saying it is now awaiting the U.S. response. The Syrian military says it has targeted Turkey's bases in the northern part of the country after earlier Turkish airstrikes killed three Syrian soldiers. And Tunisia's new constitution comes into effect as the opposition cries foul, saying it unravels the country's democratic gains. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has provided the European Union with its final conclusion on the bloc proposal for the revival of the 2015 agreement. Tehran is now awaiting the response from the bloc, which acts as a coordinator for the JCPOA revival talks. Iran's foreign minister earlier said that he sees no obstacle in the deal if the national red lines are respected. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Washington must show flexibility and adopt a realistic approach if it's serious about reviving the nuclear agreement. Based on the EU proposed text, Amir Abdullahian said, it would not be the end for the world if the U.S. fails to do so. He warned that Iran has its own plan B if the talks don't result in an agreement.
They talk about plan B. We also have our own plan B, but we believe that in the end, this matter should be resolved with the realistic approach of all parties through negotiations.
The EU now says it is examining Tehran's response. The U.S. has also said it has received Iran's response and is studying it. Last week, the European Union put forth what it called the final text for the revival of the 2015 agreement. The deal was thrown into chaos after the U.S. pulled out of it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. The remaining signatories have been engaged in talks in Vienna since April last year to revive the accord. Abbas Aslani is a research fellow at the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies in Tehran. He explains Iran's stance in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal.
Well, Iranian current administration has been saying that its foreign policy does not rely only on the JCPOA. An Iranian president in his first press conference said that Iranian foreign policy under his administration will not start from the JCPOA, and it will not be limited to the nuclear deal. It means that Iran also sees other alternatives and options in order to improve its foreign relations with other countries. And we have been seeing that in the past, let's say, months or in the past year, in the tenure of the current Iranian president, Iran has been trying to engage in economic cooperation with neighboring countries or regional countries, and to somehow find opportunities for more trade, let's say, engagements with other countries. In case that there is no agreement, Tehran, what is arguing is that it will try to continue to find new opportunities independent of the nuclear deal. However, it will not ignore this chance of the negotiations in order to lift the sanctions. You know, there is the argument that the nuclear deal or reviving the deal is not the, let's say, the panacea to the problems in the country. But what is needed is the, trying to find those potentials in order to increase the level of, let's say, trade volume with other countries.
Syrian media say Turkey has carried out deadly airstrikes on the Arab country. Three military personnel have been killed. Turkish warplanes targeted military positions on the outskirts of Aleppo. Six soldiers were also injured. Military sources say the strikes were part of Turkey's long-running efforts in support of terrorist groups in northern Syria. The Syrian army responded by targeting Turkish bases inside Syria. The army also targeted the positions of armed groups and damaged their training centers. Syrian military sources say any attack on Syrian army's position by Turkey will not go unanswered. Over a dozen diplomats have visited Gaza to assess the humanitarian situation in the blockaded coastal territory following a recent Israeli military aggression. More details by Ashraf Shana.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting, where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives, who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory. Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
1 year has passed since the fall of Kabul to the Taliban and the end of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. Since then, the country has been facing major problems which have caused serious difficulties for the Afghan people. Rahmatullah Baghwan reports.
Mid-August this year marked the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the U.S. massive withdrawal from the country after 2 decades of military presence. The last year U.S.-led evacuation turned violent and tragic, during which many Afghan people lost their lives. Sports champion Muhammad John, who was shot dead at the Kabul airport, was one of the victims. His parents blamed the U.S. for the tragic incident and are seeking compensation for the loss of their boy.
The U.S. and its allies are 100% to blame for the martyrdom of our beloved ones at the airport because they invited people and gave them hope of getting them out of Afghanistan. The U.S. not only did not provide the people with security, but also opened fire on them. They killed and injured at least 400 people, including my son. We are waiting for compensation from those who committed the crime.
The U.S. two-decade invasion of Afghanistan ended with the withdrawal of the last U.S. troops from Kabul last year. However, Afghans say Washington has started another war against them, a dangerous economic war. Since the Taliban's return to power on August 15, 2021, the U.S. has frozen nearly $9 billion in Afghanistan foreign reserves and cut off major international funding. The sanctions have pushed Afghanistan's economy to the brink of collapse, with 97% of Afghans living in poverty. Afghan people and international bodies have been calling for the release of funds so that the country could cope with the ongoing humanitarian crisis.
The United States The impacts of the U.S. seizure of Afghan assets have not been less than the damages of their 20-year war. When the U.S. sanctions were imposed on Afghanistan, the fragile economy started to shrink. Banking system crashed and people went out of cash. The money they had on their hands lost its value. Today, 1 year on, the conditions are deepening, so the U.S. and the international communities are obliged to unfreeze the assets and let the flow of aid to the country.
Meanwhile, violence and bloodshed have continued under the Taliban. The country saw a rise in deadly attacks against the Shia community last year, mostly carried out by the Daesh terrorist group. 1 year into the Taliban's return to power, Afghans are still grappling with multiple crises. However, they are happy that the U.S. occupation of their country has ended. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Tunisia, a new constitution has come into force. This after the country's electoral commission approved the final results of last month's referendum. The commission says almost 95% of the votes were in favor of the new constitution. The turnout, however, was low. Around 31% of the electorate took part. The new constitution expands President Kais Saied's powers while reducing those of the parliament. Opponents of the president say the new constitution will unravel Tunisia's democratic gains from 2011. Sajid and his supporters have said that the political system needs to change to save Tunisia from years of stagnation and political paralysis. Meanwhile, Kenya is bracing for a legal battle as opposition leader Raila Odinga has challenged the presidential election results, which saw incumbent Deputy President William Ruto as a winner.
What we saw yesterday was a travesty and a blatant disregard of the Constitution and the laws of Kenya by Mr. Chebukati and a minority of IEBC commissioners. The law does not vest in the chairperson the powers of a dictator to rule the IEBC unilaterally.
Odinga, who was in his fifth bid for presidency, refused to concede, saying the country's democracy has suffered a setback. He also vowed to pursue legal means to challenge the decision of the Election Commission. Ruto was declared a victor with some 50.5% of the ballot, but more than half of the commission refused to endorse him. Moments before the announcement, scuffles broke out in the vote tally center. Odinga's strongholds, namely the cities of Kisumu and Nairobi, protesters also battled the police and burned tires overnight. The East African country was hoping for an orderly transition of power after almost a decade under President Uhuru Kenyatta, but concerns about vote rigging linger as such disputes in the past have spiraled into bloodshed. The last French soldier has been expelled from Mali, ending nearly a decade of military disaster and humanitarian catastrophe in the African country. The new government in Bamako has refused to even allow a French ambassador to return, causing many to wonder if the era of French neo-colonialism has begun its ending. Ramin Mazahari reports.
The last French soldiers have left Mali after being expelled by Bamako following 9 years of unpopular war, which has left Mali one of the poorest countries in the world. 2.5 million refugees have been created, thousands of civilians were killed, and the politicians who initially colluded with Paris, widely accused of corruption, were ousted by popular anti-French protests in 2020.
Malians have been dying for 9 years. Things have only gotten worse. It has spread to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and elsewhere. After 9 years, this hasn't worked, and Malians want results. However, when Malians made their revolution, France criticized and opposed it.
Roots of the Mali conflict run deep, but they all feature French aggression. In 2011, Nicolas Sarkozy illegally dropped 40 tons of arms to help overthrow the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Republic led by Muammar Gaddafi. Those arms spread to northern Mali, where the nomadic Tuaregs used them in their conflict with southern Mali, which has existed ever since imperialist France drew Mali's irregular bow-tie-shaped borders. Paris alleged the Tuaregs were religious radicals, and in 2013, François Hollande invaded Mali prior to receiving the approval of the United Nations. Many allege that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines, and the desire to maintain the neo-colonial system known as Françafrique were the primary motivations for a war which would be dubbed France's Afghanistan.
Many of France's former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s, but since 1960, France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa.
France has been completely wrong about so many things, and especially the times we now live in. This is a multipolar world, and neocolonialism has failed. Africa no longer wants France and the West as their only ally and as their tutors. Africa has changed, and we will choose our own partners and our own destiny.
The war killed 59 French soldiers, but French imperialism in Mali was cited repeatedly as justification in terror attacks in France, which cost hundreds of lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Sri Lanka's government says it will not extend a state of emergency imposed to control anti-government protests as the circumstances have stabilized. Emergency regulations allow troop and police to arrest and detain suspects for long periods. The state of emergency has been widely criticized by rights groups. It allows the president to make regulations and limit the freedoms of citizens without judicial review. The country's new president invoked such rules shortly after his predecessor fled the country and resigned last month when thousands of protesters overran his official residence. The country has seen months of protests over acute shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. Top presidential contenders in Brazil have launched campaigns as the South American country is bracing for a high-stake election in October. Far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro is vying for re-election. Another front-runner is former leftist president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Both leaders have been on the campaign trail for months, but Bolsonaro, who is trailing in opinion polls, has warned that he will not give up power if defeated. He has escalated fears of possible turmoil in the country. Bolsonaro has also cast doubt on the country's electronic voting system. His popularity is on the decline over a series of cases from the coronavirus death toll to the soaring inflation. The latest poll shows Lula is currently leading with 44% of the votes. If no candidate gets more than 50% threshold, a runoff will be held on October 30th. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Heat waves, droughts, floods, and storms push up the number of cases, make diseases more severe, and hamper people's ability to cope, says Mackenzie Prillman-Ryder in an article published under the heading Climate change is making hundreds of diseases much worse. Stay tuned for more. Climate change has exacerbated more than 200 infectious diseases and dozens of non-transmissible conditions, such as poisonous snake bites, according to an analysis. Climate hazards bring people and disease-causing organisms closer together, leading to a rise in cases. Global warming can also make some conditions more severe and affect how well people fight off infections. Most studies on the associations between climate change and disease have focused on specific pathogens, transmission methods, or the effects of one type of extreme weather. Camilo Mora, a data scientist at the University of Hawaii at Mauna, and his colleagues scoured the literature for evidence of how 10 climate change-induced hazards, including surging temperatures, sea level rise, and droughts, have affected all documented infectious diseases. These include infections spread or triggered by bacteria, viruses, animals, fungi, and plants. The study was published in Nature Climate Change on August 8. Looking at basically all the climate effects and all the infectious pathogens in one paper is extremely ambitious, says Josh Colston, an epidemiologist at the University of Virginia School of Medicine in Charlottesville, adding, "They synthesize a tremendous amount of information very well. The study quantifies the many ways in which climate change affects human diseases," says Mora, adding, "We are going to be under the constant umbrella of this serious threat for the rest of our life." Mora and his colleagues examined more than 77,000 research papers, reports, and books for records of infectious diseases influenced by climatic hazards that had been made worse by greenhouse gas emissions. More than 90% of the relevant papers had been published after 2000. Ultimately, the team found 830 publications containing 3,213 case examples. The researchers discovered that climate change has aggravated 218, or 58%, of the 375 infectious diseases listed in the Global Infectious Diseases and Epidemiology Network, GIDEON, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Notifiable Diseases Surveillance System. The total rises to 277 when including non-transmissible conditions such as asthma and poisonous snake or insect bites. The team also identified 9 diseases that are diminished by climate change. Many studies examine transmissible diseases because the conditions can transfer between people and are therefore feared the most, says Mora. But as he and his colleagues gathered more data, they found reports of worsening non-communicable diseases such as asthma outbreaks caused by increased level of plant and fungal allergens because of global warming. Those allergens are still pathogens, biological agents that cause harm to the human body, says Mora, adding, but nobody is paying attention to them. The team also identified 1,600 ways in which climatic hazards have led to cases of disease. Many of those involved bringing pathogens and people closer together. Increases in temperature and rainfall, for example, have expanded the range of mosquitoes and contributed to outbreaks of dengue fever and malaria. At the same time, heat waves draw more people to water-related activities, leading to a rise in cases of waterborne illnesses, such as gastroenteritis. Storms, sea level rise and floods force people to move and have been implicated in outbreaks of Lassa fever, cholera and typhoid fever. Climate threats have also made some pathogens more virulent or boosted their transmission. For example, high temperatures increase the survival and biting rates of mosquitoes carrying West Nile virus. Furthermore, these hazards weaken people's ability to cope with infections through factors such as mental stress, lowered immunity, and malnutrition. It's incredible to have this evidence base that they have put together, says Colin Carlson, a global change biologist at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., but he notes there are even more diseases known to be influenced by climate change, and the effects of climate change on diseases are even broader than the study reveals. For instance, changing environmental conditions are harming healthcare access, food security, and other health outcomes, which are beyond the scope of the paper. He says there is no part of global health and climate change isn't reshaping.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Ilmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much. Jazakallah.
Well, brother, today's session, I'd like to start with a parent question, which reads like, what can I do with my teenagers who do things that are completely new, sometimes weird things like making new hairstyles or dressing in a particular way, or going out at a particular time, or very opinionated? Now, since we heard the question, how do we deal with this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is very common, as the last word of the question was very precise. A teenager who's very opinionated, very often you find that teenagers come with their own opinions, and they want to do things very differently. And
true.
Very often, mothers and fathers are very shocked or don't understand, can't comprehend.
What's going on?
Exactly. What's going on? What is this new thing that's coming in our lives? And how to deal with it? That's a very important question. Let me suggest a traffic light system. So traffic light, I mean, you all know what traffic light is. You have red, orange, and green. And so based on this traffic light system, you deal with this new opinion that's come in the house from this teenager in a particular way. So the green light in the traffic light is for things that are very new, the opinions that a teenager will come with, but they're not necessarily bad thing.
Okay. Right?
So for example, they're a new type of, I don't know, a clothing that has a new color. I mean, who would have thought talking 20 years ago, 30 years ago, who would have thought that it was very normal for men to wear pink shirts?
Okay. Right?
Today, people are probably laughing at me like, why do you find this weird?
Are you a girl? You're looking
No, they would find it very weird for me to ask this question. But in my generation and before that, and I'm not that old, wearing pink for a man was very, it was absolutely weird.
Okay.
Yeah. But today's world is very normal to do this. But at the same time, if you look at it, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a different color, I guess, right?
Mm.
Or for example, your teenager eating a particular type of food, which is not necessarily haram, not necessarily harmful, just different, right?
Okay.
I remember some parents were claiming that my child come back and wants to eat sushi. Okay. I've never had sushi in my life, I guess. But there's nothing wrong with having sushi. I guess it's a different type of food.
Okay.
From a different culture, and it's fine. So this you deal with it with the green traffic light, and you say that I'll support and I'll strengthen. Actually, I mean, there's no issue with it,
mm-hmm.
Even though it's very new, very different, something that in our family we haven't seen this before. But as long as it's not harmful, it's not haram.
It's okay.
It's okay, and not just it's okay, but we'll also support it.
Okay.
Show support.
Show support. Okay.
Don't ignore it as well. Because very often teenagers, they also want attention from this. So if they're bringing sushi at home, this is a very silly example, I know. But just as an example, if they bring sushi at home, for example.
Okay.
Be supportive. Be say, wow, I'll try it as well.
Okay.
However hard that might be, try it. Support it, strengthen it. It really builds bonds with the teenagers.
Okay, so you're trying to say that if our teenagers are trying to do some new things that sound a little weird to us, if we have to analyze if the things they are doing are in line with religion, we have to show support for them. Well, I'll talk more on that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. We have Brother McDodd with us in the studio. Brother McDodd, you were saying how do we deal with the teenagers who do different things?
The second light is the yellow or orange light.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is when your teenager comes with a very new thing, but that is kind of against certain principles that we have at home.
Okay.
Or in most cases, it's a borderline that with something that will very quickly could potentially turn into something haram.
Okay.
Or something harmful.
Mm-hmm.
Or thirdly, it's something that you know stems from something that's not good. So in itself, it's not a bad thing, but you know that where it's coming from is not a good thing.
Okay.
Just give you a few examples. So a particular hairstyle, but very exotic or very out there hairstyle, for example.
Okay.
So in itself, it's not a bad thing. Right? Uh-huh. It's not a haram hairstyle, but you know that it's coming from somewhere else. It's been influenced by a particular person, a particular role model.
Or particular celebrity.
Or celebrity. Or you know that it can lead to something greater, more dangerous. Or take, for example, to give a couple more examples. One is wearing, drinking drinks that are very close to alcohol but not haram.
Okay.
Right? So they're bottles of beer, for example.
Yeah.
That look exactly like beers. That even a name behind that as well. But In terms of Sharan, they're very halal. There's nothing alcoholic in it.
Okay.
But you know from different contexts that this is coming from somewhere else, right? So it's not haram in itself, but you know that there is something behind it.
Where it roots from.
Exactly. So this is where your orange light comes up in the traffic light, where you don't necessarily
stop
it or oppose it, right?
But you do not either support.
Exactly. So you don't support it. You observe what's happening without interfering first, right? So, and you find out what's happening. Where does it come from? Where is a friend circle? Is it a matter of lack of confidence? Have they been watching or listening to something particular that has led to this? Find out and identify the source for this.
Okay.
And then tackle with the source. So don't oppose directly the action itself, but tackle the source. And tackle it with, obviously, respect, with a discussion, with...
Smartness
and tactfulness, basically, in a way that you deal. But don't, as I mentioned, don't deal with the action itself. Deal with what's happening in the background, basically. That background is the source of it. That's the way you want to tackle it. And this is very important. Through different ways you can do this. Very indirect approach.
Okay.
Very often through dialogue, through finding out more. Mm-hmm. Even sometimes to taking some actions, basically.
And you also said that we don't need to interfere. We need to observe first. Because interfering
Why? Because we need to be sure that this is... Because sometimes you could sense it, but you might not be 100% sure. So make sure you know where this is coming from first.
Yes. So research and analysis and observation is necessary before we say or do anything. Brother, I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are saying how we can deal with the teenagers who come up with weird things. Now we just discussed two forms of dealing in the form of a traffic light where you can support and where you can be a little cautious. And now, where to stop?
So the red light is where teenagers come with things that are haram. In our religion, against our Sharia, or things that are very strongly against cultural or social norms and principles that everybody deals with them or everybody lives by them, and your teenagers go against them very strongly.
Okay.
These are things that are red lights, so you oppose them. But obviously, how do we oppose them is through discussion, firstly. So you discuss with your teenager about why this is something that we don't want, basically. Why we don't respect this, why we don't like this to happen in our
house. So you have to come up with your own reason first.
Exactly. You have to discuss it.
Okay.
Never criticize the person. Never criticize the teenager and says, you're a bad boy, you're a bad girl. Or
how do you do this?
Exactly. Why do you do this, etc. Always talk about the action. Say that this, doing this, for example, is not a right thing to do. Exactly. So never criticize the person. Always talk about the action itself.
Okay.
Always show care and concern. So don't say, I'm opposing it because it's against my religion, against my house, and against my culture. No. Show concern for the person, for the teenager. Say, because I want the best for you, because I want you to be successful in life, because I want you to get closer to Allah and be happy in your life. Because of you, I'm saying that this is something that this should not be done, basically, or this is something that should stop from happening. And you should take care of not doing this. So showing a lot of care, a lot of concern, a lot of love for the teenagers, and a lot of respect as well. Understand them, hear them out. Very often you find that there might be a misunderstanding, right? So always clarify the misunderstanding. Say, okay, ask them, where does this come from? Why does this happen? What are they trying to achieve through this, by doing this? And through that, you'll be able to understand. But show your opposition to this. Show that you're not happy with it.
Yeah.
Have logical and clear arguments. And have clear lines as well. Self, if you do this, then this is the red line. But if you change a little bit, then you could be actually very okay.
Okay.
So, I don't know. It could be, for example, something that's haram, for example. But if they were to change a little bit, then they would actually be okay to do it.
Okay.
Take the example of music, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? Sometimes they, when you want to deal with music, you can tell them, look, if you change music, and because music is haram, this type of music, you can suggest alternative to music.
Okay. Right?
Don't say, I'll take your headphones away and you can't listen to anything. Say, this is haram, but what if you choose another type of music, for example?
You have to provide alternatives.
Exactly. And show them that you care and you understand
your
them.
Concern.
You're listening, you're concerned. And
okay. But most of the parents, you know, why they fail over here is because I think they kind of try to show power, the authority, rather than discussing things or showing concern. So you recommend and you suggest, rather than showing the authority and power, we need to show care and concern. And the best way is to discuss things with the teenagers. And when you're taking away something haram from them, you have to provide them with the alternatives, obviously with the halal alternatives. Well, that was all for today. Thank you so much, brother, for joining us. Thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanillah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. When elected leaders put party before country, Americans are diminished as a society. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The article has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper and is titled, Liz Cheney and Lisa Murkowski Face Their Voters. When elected leaders put party before country, Americans are diminished as a society. We grow cynical. We believe less. We vote less. Every so often, however, we witness a leader who takes a principled stance, at odds with the party leaders and supporters, or even both, and ultimately against his or her own self-interest. In our era of partisan warfare, these principled acts amount to political bravery, and they are essential to democracy, helping replenish our belief in leadership and, in some cases, our trust in the rule of law being followed. These acts of political bravery are also a powerful reminder that the structural flaws in our political system lessen the incentive to be brave. Leaders who follow their principles risk alienating donors, alienating party bosses and voters who may scream betrayal rather than seek a measure of understanding. When Senator Mitt Romney cast a sole Republican vote to convict President Donald Trump for abuse of power in his first impeachment trial, Republicans nationally and in Utah criticized the senator. His own niece, Ronna McDaniel, the chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, defended Donald Trump and chided Mitt. When Mayor Jacob Frey of Minneapolis refused to commit to defunding the police amid a crowd of protesters after the murder of George Floyd, he was booed away, leaving to jeers of shame, shame. These examples of leadership, whether you agree with those positions or not, are important moments in the political life of a country. It's worth taking note of them at a time when they are under particularly fierce attack. It's also worth noting that the stakes of the current moment are only going to require more of such acts, particularly among Republicans. On Tuesday, two Republicans, Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, faced primary challenges as they each seek another term in Congress. They are both running against opponents backed by Donald Trump. Indeed, their political fates are in question solely because they stood up to Mr. Trump when it would have been much safer and politically expedient not to do so. They are not unlike those Republicans who faced primary challenges and in some cases defeat in 1974 after supporting articles of impeachment against President Richard Nixon. And while circumstances differ, they also call to mind those Democrats who voted for the Affordable Care Act in 2010 and lost re-election that fall, or Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, whose efforts to fight the COVID-19 pandemic made her a divisive figure. She too did not take the safe and politically expedient course. She became the target of an alleged kidnapping plot in 2020 and is being challenged for re-election this fall by a Trump-backed Republican. Liz Cheney and Lisa Murkowski are in fact offering two models of political bravery at a time when straight, down-the-line party support is more and more common. Ms. Cheney's model is that of a consistent conservative who, on a critical issue that has become a litmus test in the party, took the right stance, calling out Donald Trump's election lies and attempting to hold him accountable for subverting American democracy and fomenting the January 6th attack on the Capitol. First, she lost her House leadership position. Now, as one of only two House Republicans to serve on the January 6th committee, she is likely to lose on Tuesday to a Wyoming Republican championed by Donald Trump. The former president is deep in the revenge business these days. She has a different purpose. While Ms. Cheney voted in line with Donald Trump nearly 93% of the time, her commitment is to the rule of law, and her resolve to put country above party is clearly more important to her than blind loyalty. Whatever happened on Tuesday, history will remember Liz Cheney for her principles, just as it will remember Donald Trump for his lack of them. Lisa Murkowski's model is that of a more moderate pragmatist with a history of crossing the aisle on some crucial legislation and votes, against the drift of many Alaska Republicans. Lisa Murkowski did not go along with the party's attempts to undo the Affordable Care Act, and she opposed the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh and supported confirmation of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. She also helped broker the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill last year. But it was her vote to convict Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial that now has him seeking political payback. She was one of seven GOP senators to find Donald Trump guilty then. She is the first to face re-election. Her prospects are better than Liz Cheney's. She competed in an open primary on Tuesday, with the top four finishers moving on to a November election that will use a ranked choice voting system. Lisa Murkowski is still one of the most vulnerable Senate Republicans in this year's elections, but Alaska's system gives her a chance to be judged by all of the voters in Alaska rather than registered Republicans alone. Both models of political bravery bring to mind another Republican, Senator John McCain, with his thumbs-down vote in 2017 that helped preserve the Affordable Care Act, and with his bipartisan efforts on some policy issues, like immigration reform. And on the surface, Lisa Murkowski's affinity for bipartisan coalitions, which annoys some on the right, is shared by two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, which annoys some on the left. The duo are better known for stonewalling Democratic legislation than crossing the aisle to get legislation passed. But plenty of moderate Democrats and independents see them as taking a stand in defense of consensus and compromise, neither of which is politically in vogue these days. The positions of Liz Cheney and Lisa Murkowski stand in sharp relief to so many of this season's Republican candidates, who are launching scorched-earth attacks on Democrats as liars, even as they continue to promote Donald Trump's big lie. Some MAGA Republicans like to pretend that they're brave with shows of chest-beating, name-calling and machismo, and complaints about being persecuted by social media and the news media. But so much of this is political theatre aimed at whipping up the Trump base, and none of it requires moral courage. Violence, like the violence unleashed during the January 6 attack on the Capitol, is an ever-present and growing response to political bravery in our democracy. It was there at the Capitol on that day. It was there in the hate aimed at John Lewis and his fellow marchers in Selma. It was present in the alleged kidnapping plot aimed at Gretchen Whitmer. And it is present in the stream of death threats endured by politicians in both political parties wherever they cross a line. There are few incentives for politicians to exhibit bravery today. In a recent New York Times opinion focus group exploring instances of courage and bravery in politics, 6 of the 10 participants, including 4 independents and 1 who leans Republican, said they thought President Biden's decision to withdraw troops from Afghanistan was politically brave. There are a few of us here who are old enough to remember the withdrawal of troops from Vietnam and a similar way that it played out in Afghanistan, one of the independents said. But it was something that needed to be done. It was not popular, but it was very courageous. Yet the chaos and bloodshed of the withdrawal are the first things that many Americans recall about it. Future generations may recall Joe Biden's decision to remain steadfast in his decision, but in the immediate aftermath of the withdrawal, Biden faced severe public criticism and a sharp drop in his popularity. Barbara Lee, the veteran Democratic congresswoman from California, is familiar with this lack of incentives. In the days after the 11th of September 2001 terrorist attacks, she emerged as the sole voice in Congress to oppose the authorization of military force sought by the Bush administration as a means of responding to the cataclysmic events of that month. Barbara Lee recalled recently that her Democratic colleagues warned her at the time that the party couldn't make military force a partisan issue in a moment of crisis. "I said we can't do this, it's overly broad and setting the stage for forever war." And after she cast her nay in what would be a 420-1 vote, Barbara Lee recalled that her friends in the House thought I was making a mistake, saying, "You are doing all this good work on HIV and AIDS and foreign affairs. We don't want to lose you." Some colleagues feared for her safety, others for her re-election, she said. "I got death threats, people's shotgun shots into my voicemail," Barbara Lee said. "The threats lasted for a long time. They don't come often as often now, but I still get threats today." Barbara Lee faced a primary challenger the following year but was re-elected. She sees a parallel between her experience and Liz Cheney's. "In a strong democracy, there is the right to dissent," Ms. Lee said. "She is dissenting as I chose to do." Bravery alone is not enough to heal the nation's partisan divisions. Timothy Naftali, a historian of the Richard Nixon era, said he fears that the country is far more divided now than it was back then. "We did not form a consensus about Donald Trump after 6th of January 2021, like many Americans did in the summer of 1974 regarding Richard Nixon's abuses of power," he said. "And even the most courageous, principled stand may not change the minds of diehard partisans," Mr. Naftali noted. "Even after the months of work by Liz Cheney and so many others on the January 6th committee, some recent opinion polls show that it hasn't really changed public opinion about the former president, Donald Trump. While Liz Cheney is very likely to lose her primary on Tuesday, she is not sounding any regrets. If the cost of standing up for the Constitution is losing the House seat," she recently told the New York Times, "then that's a price that I'm willing to pay. Democracy needs more profiles encouraged like that."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.